I've watched that final possession, the offensive possession, like a dozen times.
You were expecting Marcus Smart to
100% expecting Marcus Smart to I've covered Marcus Smart in Boston for what, 9 years now he's been in the league? Like every other year he pulls that shot.
Hello, welcome back. Great show. Today, the NBA playoffs are in full swing, and we've got some wonderful talk lined up for you. Gosh, it is my absolute pleasure to have the co-host of Airbuds and Sorry We Love the NFL and my good friend, one of the funniest human beings ever to do it, ever to step in front of a mic. It's Jamel Johnson. Jamel, how are you?
For a second, I thought you were going to say like Dougie Doug or... something. I was like, oh, it is me. I'm good, bro. Happy to see you. Apologies for having to watch a Knicks playoffs again.
Apologies for having to watch a Wizardless playoffs once again, but we'll get
Thank
into
you,
that.
Sir. We're also it's like church greetings.
It really is. We also talked to Andy Larson of the Salt Lake Tribune about the Jazz and the Mavs. We'll get to the Nets Celtics series with Chris Mannix of Sports Illustrated. But first, let's just talk about what we've been seeing so far with producers Ryan and Zuri, super producers Ryan and Zuri. Let's start with, man, the series that I think they should make the entire playoffs out of, T-Wolves, Grizzlies. This is the series, folks, that made me tweet, I don't want to see old players anymore. I believe this. I think the NBA should cap old players per team at 2. You can't have more than 2 30-year-old players on a team. And I'm basing that on how fun T-Wolves Grizzlies are. Fellas, what are we thinking about this series? Jamel, let's start with you.
First off, I agree. As a fan of the Big Three, I 100% agree. Let's get some youth in the building. But also, I mean, you know what? Honestly, I'm happy to see Anthony Edwards shining. Yeah. This is number one pick behavior. And everybody was worried. And he's actually incredible.
I love my shots is yet another iconic, iconic statement from Anthony Edwards, who said after the game, quote, I love my shots. Whatever shot I take, whether it's a step back tray ball or a step back mid range or a floater or a layup, whatever my shot is, I like it.
He also
sometimes
him.
Coach may not like it. Shouts to the guy, Chris Finch, but I love my shot.
My favorite thing he does is when he thinks he's going to make a shot and he pimps it, but it's like 2 feet past the rim. It's the confidence. The confidence is great. And I do wonder if we do ban old players, like, where do they go if you're over 30? And then
they go to the Big Three.
It would actually be good for, like, all three levels of basketball because more college players would make the association because of age limitations. And then the Big Three would get an influx of veteran presence that we all still want to see.
It would be pretty cool.
It's trickle-down basketballonomics. You know what I'm saying? Like, here's the thing about that Anthony Edwards thing you were talking about, Zuri. Yes, he does some goofy stuff sometimes that will drive you crazy. I was thinking, man, if Tom Thibodeau was watching that, if he was the coach of that team, he'd go walk into the ocean after some of those shots. And all season, Karl-Anthony Towns has had a penchant with, I think he's too influenced by Jokic. He'll do these very, very lazy, like, hook passes over the head where he's, like, kind of not looking and it's real slow and it's easy to pick off. Happened a bunch of times in the game. But when you have players that young and talented and exciting, I don't care. I would rather watch that than Taj Gibson making the right play a million times and he can't jump over a business card. Like, I want to watch young players who are exciting. I don't care if they make a lot of mistakes. I love this series. There's just so much excitement. Dylan Brooks, Ja. Like, the young players are just showing out. It's really, really fun.
Jaren Jackson was the weak link for the Grizz. Hopefully he doesn't have a little clunker in then game two. The
7 blocks, though. I mean, yeah, well, like, he's legitimately, if he cannot foul, he was negative 16 in the game. That's okay. If he cannot foul, I mean, like, Rudy Gobert defense ability with scoring. Like, he can be fun.
Just need you to cash those open threes because Ja's drawing too because Pat Beverly can't guard him. No one in the building can guard Ja, so he will be getting open shots the whole series.
You know, we tried to throw a little, we tried to throw a little shade on the Timberwolves party for making the playoffs at all, saying like, oh, this is going to be their final. You know, they came out and they got that game one win. Now they only need three more in six. Three of them are going to be at home. You know, it's interesting. So I think that we wrote them off a little bit too quickly. And I'm happy to see Pat Bev and company out here, you know, representing themselves well against this two seed.
I just want this to go seven.
Well, do you guys have have a pick for this series? Do you think Minnesota takes it or do you even care?
I think it's, you know, it's almost impossible to not overreact to a game one when you watch it, you know, and allow that to color how you feel about the series. Do they get 23 from Malik Beasley again? You know what I mean? Like, I'm hoping this goes seven, and I think it's a Grizzlies win ultimately. I think that they're just too good and too deep. They are a little bit more forged in fire. I understand that they're both kind of like inexperienced teams with regards to the playoffs, but the Grizzlies did it for an extended part of the series without Ja and show that they have an ability to go deep and to win games with Bane and with Melton and with Jaren Jackson Jr., with Dylan Brooks. Like, they have guys that understand their role and know how to play. And I feel like the Timberwolves have a little bit further to go in terms of figuring it out. So I still pick the Grizzlies, but I'm hoping it's going to be a long series.
If you have two young teams and you go six, seven games in the series, and you know there's no real loser. Obviously, someone has to be eliminated for the sake of the playoffs, but the reps are just so good for like every single young player on both rosters. I think it goes six, seven games, and I do think that the Grizz went out, but like, going into this series, going into this season, I would look at the Timberwolves roster and say, soft talent, like D'Lo, Cat, you know? So it's a situation where Anthony Edwards even, you know, he's figuring it out this season. He's kind of ascending before our eyes. So I think that this is going to be a good experience for them no matter what. And, you know, you steal a road game in game one and just like you start playing the numbers. If they play well at home, it can get to seven, and in a game seven, anything could happen.
Anthony Edwards had two blocks in this game. I mean, you know, like they were playing.
I agree. I think Memphis in seven. I think D'Angelo wakes up at home, 10 points on 2 for 11 shooting game one. I think he turns that around. But then probably, I mean, this is not a real prediction, but I think Towns lays another egg at some point in the series, and that's probably what.
Why they lose? Yeah. I could see that. I just think offensively, if he can limit his turnovers, Minnesota plays really intelligently. It's like when he had a small on him, he's going down low, and when he had space, he's shooting from outside. That's a dangerous player. I'm really excited. I just love this series. No more old players. No more old players. I don't want to see it anymore. I'm so tired of it. Okay, next series, folks. It was Schadenfreude HQ at my apartment. As I was watching, the Miami Heat absolutely put Trae Young and the Atlanta Hawks in a fucking dungeon and then dropped the dungeon like into a hellhole. Folks, it was despicable behavior from the Heat, who limited Trae Young to like 1 for 700 shots and to multiple complaints and multiple borderline slash dirty hits after the whistle under the brim. Kyle Lowry shoving his hands all up in Trae Young's face, diving at his knees at the buzzer, like at halftime. It was ugly, and the Miami Heat absolutely rampaged to a 115-91 victory. Thoughts all around, Jamel.
The Heat seemed excited to hit somebody not on their own roster. They've been going at it for weeks now, and they're just so excited that there's somebody else in similar color jerseys, which I think helps.
Yes. Now they have extra incentive to be mad about something.
Exactly. And I mean, they look good, man. If Duncan Robinson's going to be doing that, I mean, what can you do?
I mean, no one's going to stop. I mean, ultimately, it's like, is he going to miss? Because the way they're executing is just kind of insane.
I just think we shouldn't write off Trae Young. He was so great in the two play-in games leading into this. And I think that they're just dealt with a little, you know, lethargy heading into this game. And I think, like, for my money, I think Trae's, like, pound for pound the best with the basketball in the league. I think he makes the smartest decisions given his size. And I just wouldn't write him off. I do think, though, Miami in, like, five or six. But
wait, hold on a second. I'm not writing him off.
You wrote him off.
I'm not writing him off.
You
wrote
as
him
he's
off.
Actively writing.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
He's writing it in
you
cursive.
Didn't just, you didn't just write him off. You initialed at the top of the page and at the bottom of the page.
I didn't sign my name, but my initials are on it. I just think it's, you know, we're gonna see big games from him. He'll steal a win or two, but. Probably Miami.
Yeah. Ryan?
I think that a gentleman's sweep is probably the best that Atlanta can hope for. If it gets to game six, I'd be shocked. I just think that Trae Young, the offense obviously runs through Trae Young, and it's never going to be able to keep up with Miami without Trae Young doing well. And the defensive rotations that he's going to see in this series are just nightmarish for him. If it's not Lowry, it's going to be Tucker. If it's not Tucker, it's going to be Butler. All of them look like seventh graders playing basketball with a fourth grader and one-on-one. And frankly, I just want to put it out there. I think Knicks Nation is like heavy on the South Beach blow right now. Where
I mean, I'm
loving this content. It is cathartic.
I'm not proud of it.
To see him.
I'm not proud of it. I'm not proud of it, but I am right there. I'm enjoying this to the hilt. I absolutely love it. I love watching him struggle. It's fun. It was fun watching him do in the Cavs, honestly, like in the final play-in game. It was fun watching him do that to another player. But I think you're right in that those rotations, watching him against the Cavs, every time he get in that pick and roll and find space, he's stabbing the Cavs to death, ice picking them to death with that floater. Because if you switch on Trae, there's any gap in your rotation, you're dead. The Heat are not showing you a gap. And there's no soft guy on the. There's really no minus defender anywhere in the rotation that Trae is going to see. First three rotations, four rotations, it's like, to your point, it's like Lowry, PJ, Butler, and Bam. He's seeing size. He's seeing physicality. He's seeing guys that are just in his jersey all the time. You watch him, and he's seeing two guys every single time. They're like, listen, give up the ball. And when he gives it up, he's not getting it back. And so Bogey Bogdanovich is going to have to do some stuff. And Trae has been resistant his whole career to playing off the ball. It's obviously too late to be like, hey, let's run some off the ball shit now with Trae. With you know, that's off season work. But I think I am not writing them off either. But I would not be surprised at a sweep here. I would not be surprised to see it. I just think that the Heat. They know how they want to take Trae out of the game. If you take Trae out of the game, there's no other way for the Hawks to get into their offense. Moving on. Raptors Sixers. I was looking at this and I was thinking, man, game seven, Doc Rivers, the Raptors.
Why is that funny? Why is that funny?
I was just getting ready. And I was looking at some of the underlying, you know, like the underlying factors that the Nick Nurse coached Raptor team. They have all these different looks they can throw at Embiid and all these different looks they can throw at Harden. And ultimately, it was easy to criticize the Sixers coming down the stretch of the season with Harden throwing up, you know, 3-for-14s and 4-for-20s, et cetera. And it was fun and it was cute to laugh at them. But ultimately, the Sixers have the two best players in the series. And if Scottie Barnes is out, it's kind of a wrap. The Raptors can't score in the half court like at all. Like their offense is terrible. And I just feel like here's another one where Philly in five, Philly in six, if something happens up in Toronto. But ultimately, I don't think this is in any doubt. The Sixers just feel like they're much better than the Raptors. Jamel?
Yeah, I'm going to say Sixers and six just because the Sixers can't win anything regular looking.
Right, that's like, the other.
It's going to look good point. They're going to look dumb as shit in Toronto at some point. Missing Thibault, somebody's going to do something stupid. But I do think that James Harden saved Tobias Harris's career.
He did.
Something about the two of them together is working for Tobias, and Philly needed it. All the trips to the strip club are paying off.
Ryan, Zuri?
So I think for this series, I think for the 76ers in general, it's like we were looking at James Harden on the Nets and the dynamic just wasn't there. It wasn't right. There was always a problem. There was always beef, whether it was mad at Kyrie's situation or not.
There was always beef going into James Harden's mouth and he was eating it and he was getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
You know, but he wasn't the player that the Nets needed to be the best version of themselves. And, you know, I don't think that Ben Simmons is either, but I do think that in Philly, James Harden is able to be like, he fits the mold here so much better, because it's not even, we talked about it yesterday, it's not about the scoring prowess. It's about his vision. Like, he can go out there and rack up the assists, and he can not shoot.
That half-court bouncer to Maxey was just electric, and that's exactly the thing that they need. They don't even need James Harden to go out there and shoot at a high percentage. We all know about James Harden's struggles in the playoffs when he gets noticeably tight and the calls aren't coming at the same clip as they were in the regular season. But, like, if he just moves the ball the way he did, that's a lot. Zuri, your thoughts?
No, I don't want to skip ahead, but I think we're destined for a Bucks Sixers Eastern Conference Finals, and these are probably trap series for the Sixers on their way to getting there. And I don't know that Toronto prepares them in the way that they need to face the Bucks eventually in the conference finals, but we'll see.
I just think, you know, I wanted the Knicks to make an offer on Fred VanVleet, even though there was no shot a couple of seasons back in free agency. Here's the issue with Fred VanVleet. I just think Trae Young is able to do what he can do at his size because he has unbelievable ball handling and infinite range. VanVleet's a good shooter, but he doesn't have the arsenal of, if you don't have that arsenal of moves, you're going to struggle. And VanVleet has to work so hard to get off and to get his team into any kind of like scoring rhythm. And man, I just think it's going to be real tough for the Raptors, depending on what happens with Barnes. But man, the Sixers look good. And shouts to all my Sixers fans who are absolutely losing their shit about Tyrese Maxey. He looked great. Nuggets Warriors. Uh-oh. If the Warriors could play like this without Curry playing well, Jordan Poole coming out, pool party. Jokic had 25 and 10, but he had to work so hard for every single thing that he got. He looked gassed out at times, to the point where Doris Burke was like, Jokic looks gassed out. And it's going to be a long series without the creativity of Michael Porter Jr. It's just like everything has to go through Jokic. And we're seeing in this playoffs, if you have one creator, Hawks, Nuggets, etc., you're going to be in trouble because the other team is going to take away that option. And it was looking real rough for the Nuggets. Thoughts, Jamel?
Yeah, I mean, it sucks that the Warriors are good.
It really does.
I thought we were over this. I didn't think this was going to keep happening, but terrible matchup for the Nuggets. I mean, yeah. You know, Draymond, Jokic might be the only player he can guard now, just in the league entirely.
Yeah.
I mean, they're putting him through hell. He still put up his numbers, but it's gonna be tough.
Will Barton took 18 shots in game one. I don't know if that's tenable for a series.
Somebody's got to.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's, you know, somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to score other than Jokic, either scoring or setting up people to score. Like, somebody's got to create who's not Nikola Jokic.
Also, what did Drake know before he put that $200,000 bet on the Warriors to win the finals? Did he know that Jordan Poole is going to be this Jordan Poole?
He knew that he was rich.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He knew his light work.
He went into it rich.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Bucks Bulls. So I think everybody expected, I certainly was thinking Bucks in five-ish. Nothing I saw really changed that. The Bulls made a run here in the series with Vooch, who got hot at the right time. Pay no attention to his actual box score, but he got hot at the right time, keyed a little run. Caruso was devastating at times. But the Bucks weren't just playing the Bulls. They were playing their history of coming up disappointing in game ones and ultimately won the game 91-86. Giannis is just incredible, just like unbelievable. And I think the Bucks are probably going to win in five. Unfortunately, it's been a fun series for the Bulls. DeRozan struggled, which is either par for the course for him or something he will bounce back from. I guess I shouldn't doubt him because I doubted him when they signed him and then he had a great season. But I guess I kind of doubt him in the playoffs, especially against a Bucks team that just kind of like knows what they're doing. Your thoughts, Jamel?
I mean, yeah, it's the Bucks, dude. This is the new America. Chris Middleton for president.
Are we?
This is just the rest of our lives. I don't think so.
Are we worried about Chris Middleton? Like, he had a kind of down season and is now having a down first game of the playoffs, albeit after a long layoff. Are we worried that he is officially washed at this point?
Never worried. I would never. I am. If I could go to Vegas and put $10 million on just Chris Middleton, I would.
On your Drake?
Yeah. On your Drake? Tag that on to Drake's bet.
And you know what? For me, it's like the Bulls had a good season. It was fun. It was a surprise. But when you look at the fact that they're the fourth best record in NBA history with a negative differential, when you look at their record against teams above 500, the writing was always kind of on the wall for them. Then the injuries start stacking up and throwing them off of the way they want to play. And the Bucks are the defending champions. Like, we're all expecting Giannis to have a shot at defending this title. And that requires, you know, a victory in the first round. So.
Negative differential. Negative differential was a bad amazing indicator. Yeah.
I did like that Brandon Jennings basically tweeted that Tristan Thompson is the reason why the Bulls season was torpedoed. I feel like he was speaking for a lot of people. Also, this reminds me of like a regional high school basketball tournament with Milwaukee and Chicago. It's kind of on the level of Knicks, Nets, Lakers, Clippers.
I would love for this to be more of a rivalry, honestly. Like, that would be really cool.
When Caruso gets elbowed in the center of his head, it will be.
Was it Doris Burke on the call for Bucks Bulls again? I think it was, right? I think at one point she said of Tristan Thompson, Tristan Thompson getting in there, which is his job, and his job really is getting in there, as we all know, on and off the court. That guy is getting in there.
Shout out Christian Mingle.
He really is getting in there. But I think it's going to be an easy Bucks win, unfortunately. Suns Pelicans. Speaking of easy wins, great season for the Pelicans, showing the scrappiness, showing that they have some depth and some exciting young players coming in. Herb Jones setting the NBA nerddom alight with his play on both ends of the floor. It's so exciting, and you think, man, if they add Zion to this, isn't that great? At the same time, man, they're not ready. And the Suns are the best team in basketball, arguably. And this is going to be a sweep. This is going to be a sweep, folks. Your thoughts, Jamel?
Suns, period.
I mean, Chris Paul. When I loved the Pelicans, like, you know, when a body twitches a little bit, when someone gets knocked out or and the leg twitches. The leg twitched and Chris Paul was like, okay, we're going to make sure they're done. We're going to make sure they're finished.
Yeah,
make sure they're finished. And he just put the finishing move on them.
Oh boy.
And went absolute 19 of his 30 in the fourth quarter and seemed like he assisted on everything as well. Like, just went crazy. Zuri, Ryan?
For me, it's very simple. These playoffs are this is his battleground. This is his ring. Mm-hmm. I feel like if it doesn't happen this season, I'm not going to. Last year when they lost, I said it'll be this year. If they lose this year, I'm not putting that same level of confidence into next year. I think it has to happen right now. Everybody on the Suns knows it. Surely Chris Paul knows it. And until somebody gives them some legitimate opposition, they're far and away from being in the league.
Until Chris Paul turns an ankle like he always does. Or
that's it. The only thing.
How dare you?
I'm not wishing injury on anyone.
It's a podcast. He had to say it.
Hey, there's evidence. Also, Herb Jones, way ahead of his time, late in the game, he like clotheslined DeAndre Ayton.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about that. play was switching over, right? DeAndre Ayton was running up the court and kind of not looking what was happening. And then Herb Jones, the way I looked at it was Herb Jones was coming in and just trying to, you know, get a check on his man, like keep DeAndre Ayton from easily running up the floor. Now, usually you'd see something like that, like on pick and roll defense when you tag a guy, but I think he was just doing like a tag. And it just so happened that Ayton, one, wasn't looking, and then Jones, overexcited, like came in a little high and rug Ayton's bell. I was a little surprised that they didn't
flagrant on that.
But it was more reckless than it was like dirty. but it was certainly intentional. And I hope Ayton's okay. They kept saying, oh, the Suns ran through their concussion protocol or whatever it is to make sure that Ayton...
In like 10 seconds. Like, you good? Yeah,
they were just like, you good?
No TV
and he was
out.
Like, yeah, I'm good. Yeah.
Still looking terrible on the... I mean, if it was unintentional, or if it was intentional, it was the most beautiful sell, the most believable sell of, like, I didn't mean to do this. Because right after he reaches back, and it seems like there was no ill will, but maybe he's a great actor. I respect it. Anyway.
Yeah, that's how I pretend to hold open elevators.
I mean, it reminded me a little bit of, like, Kyle Lowry diving at Trey's ankle at the end of the first half, and then... extending his hand and touching his ankle as if to heal it through the power of, you know, the tears of Jesus and be like, hey, I'm so, hey, are you good? Like, I didn't want to do that. You wanted to do that a little bit. You kind of a little bit wanted to do that. Any other thoughts? Yeah, this is going to be a sweep. Or, like, if somehow, some way the Suns, like, let up, then maybe the Pelicans get excited. They get a game. They showed a little bit of life again in that third quarter, but the Suns are too good. Boston and Brooklyn, it is one of the marquee matchups of this playoff. And to help us unpack what we saw in a electric game one that saw the Celtics squeeze out a victory at the buzzer 115-114 over the Brooklyn Nets is Chris Mannix of Sports Illustrated. What an absolute cracker of a game one. Is that what you were expecting? And any takeaways from what was one of the games of the weekend?
No, not at all what I expected. Kyrie's always an adventure in Boston. Like, he's created this narrative that, I don't know, like, he just is nuts. And, you know, how he seems to let the Boston fans kind of creep into his head and push him in a direction where he has to respond almost every single time is wild. And what's also wild is that it seems to motivate him. Like, you know, every time the Boston fans climb on him, he just seems to get hot and make shot after shot. And watching him last night just go off, you think for three quarters and 10 minutes that this is how it's going to end. It's going to be, you know, the Kyrie revenge game 6.0 if you go back to last year's playoffs. And so, that was the first, you know, thing that just stuck with me, how he continues to let the Boston fans seemingly get to him. The second part was, I've watched that final possession, the offensive possession, like a dozen times.
You were expecting Marcus Smart to
100% expecting Marcus Smart to shoot that. I've covered Marcus Smart in Boston for, what, 9 years now he's been in the league? Like, every other year he pulls that shot. He was 4-for-9 from three-point range in that moment.
Say your prayers, folks. That may never happen again. And what a...
That was going up.
Yeah.
That was going up. So for him not only to not take the shot, but have the presence of mind to find Tatum in that spot. I mean, unbelievable. That was the true embodiment of the evolution of Marcus Smart.
Did seem like some real growth. I never thought I'd see the day myself, bro.
I mean, there were some possessions in that fourth quarter coming down the stretch where, you know, Marcus did call his own number a couple of times and did not come up with
call
scores
waiting.
in that moment, and you're thinking, oh God, like, here we go again. And I was 100% expecting himself to call his own number in that moment, and he did not. Great pass, incredible moment. Jason Tatum, for me, like, obviously, incredible game, 31 points. But to me, it's the 8 assists. This season, when he has 5 or more assists, the Celtics are like 26-10. So, you know, a lot of the improvement for the Celtics this season came in figuring out how to move the ball better, Chris. What was it that they did that allowed them to unlock, you know, this kind of like offensive and defensive explosion over the course of the series for the Celtics? What did Udoka do?
I think he just, like, one of the reasons Ime Udoka was second on my Coach of the Year ballot, just behind Monty Williams and ahead of Taylor Jenkins, who was fantastic all year long, was I give Ime credit for coaching through the struggles. Like, this was a Celtic team that had so many bad habits, that didn't know how to do certain things, from kind of defensive philosophies with the way they switch now, which is what they didn't do under Brad Stevens, to pushing Tatum and Brown to become more of facilitators. That's not something that had to do in recent years. In recent years, they've had traditional point guards, whether it was, you know, Isaiah Thomas briefly early on, Kemba Walker or Kyrie Irving. They have been able to defer to the primary playmaker more times than not. So all season long, Ime was pushing them. You got to pass more. You got to be a facilitator. You got to move the ball. And it really wasn't until early to mid-January that they started doing that, that they started, you know, kind of looking to be more passers than scorers. And that game one was proof positive. I mean, Tatum, you know, a lot of the times when he made the right pass, previous years he would have forced up a shot or taken a three-point shot, taken one of those terrible Kobe shots that he's become obsessed with over time, the kind of mid-range jumper, fade away along the baseline, whatever. He's just different. He's different now. And that's something that he and Jaylen Brown have been pushed and pushed and pushed on since the start of the season. It really took until the midway point for them to actually start to get it. Just one more thought on Marcus Smart real quick, only because Smart, like, I mean, I do some work over at NBC for pre and post game show there. And from day one, I was jumping up and down on Marcus Smart. I didn't believe he could do this. I didn't believe he could evolve into the player he's become. And he saw everything. Like, he sees everything. And he's used that all season long, the people that don't believe he can be a primary playmaker. So, like, Marcus, to his credit, has, like, absorbed all the hate, like, taken it all inside him and pushed it out in the right direction. That's an incredible credit to him.
I also kind of forgot about Jaylen Brown's defense, you know, because everything, when you think about the Celtics, you're like, all right, who's going to be the man? Is it Brown or is it Tatum? But, like, what Tatum does on offense, Jaylen Brown does on defense. And I think we saw a lot of that. But I think the real reason the Celtics are on is because Nia Long is hanging around the facility. Everyone on the roster has a crush on this woman. You want to play your best when she comes. She's not coming all the time, so you better act right when she shows up.
Speaking of surprises showing up, Al Horford, 20 points, 15 rebounds. A lot of the talk about the Celtics once Robert Williams went out, the Time Lord, was, okay, like, to your point, Udoka has implemented more switching. So how do they piecemeal this together? And of course, you know, if you had to lose one of your important players, I guess Williams would be the guy that you think, okay, the Celtics can survive this. But they got some great play out of Al Horford. Your thoughts about what Horford did in game one?
And is it sustainable?
It's sustainable. I was worried early on for Boston in that game because, 18 fouls called in the first quarter. I mean, their depth is not great in the front court without Rob Williams, really just Grant Williams. And, you know, you go deeper into that bench, you start looking at guys that you don't want to start playing. But Al, to me, was one of the most underrated pickups of the offseason. I mean, not many people watched him play in Oklahoma City last year. Mm-hmm. But he really rehabilitated himself with the Thunder. Like, he washed off the stench of that one season in Philadelphia. And even though he only played half the year, he proved that he still had something left. And we've seen that all season long. One of the reasons that they can survive without Rob Williams, at least in the short term, is that even though you miss some weak side shot blocking with Rob Williams, you don't have to fundamentally change what you do with Al Horford and Grant Williams and Daniel Tice in that lineup. So with Al Horford at five, you can still switch everything in the same way you did with Rob Williams. Imagine if, like, Al wasn't there, like, in a different reality. Like, let's say Ennis Freedom was still there. Like, could you imagine trying to play that defense with Ennis out there on the floor? You couldn't do it because you can't switch him onto everybody the same way. You cannot do it.
You can't even Nintendo switch him. You can't do anything.
No. Absolutely would not be possible.
No, that to me is why, like, that not just Al, but like Al, Grant, and Tice, who's another, like,
yeah.
Brad Stevens really should win executive of the year. I don't even know who's the number two choice. Not a media vote, obviously. But, I mean, he did things, guys, that, like, Danny Ainge would never have done the things that Brad Stevens did. Never in a million years. He would never have forked over an unprotected first-round pick to get Al Horford and get Kemba Walker off the books. Never, ever, ever would have done that. I highly doubt he would have given up the kind of draft capital you need to get Derek White, who's also been huge for this team this year. I mean, Brad, in getting Al Horford, in acquiring Daniel Theis, who, by the way, he got killed for at the deadline. Like, remember, it's like, you only got Theis for Schroeder. Theis got a crappy contract. You couldn't get a first for Dennis Schroeder. Like, that was available. he only gets Daniel Theis for it. Like, those two guys, Horford and Theis, are the reason this team is here right now in the kind of position that they're in.
I guess we simply must talk about the vibe in the arena. The double bird flip off behind the head move from Kyrie.
Does he think they're not going to see that? Like, does he think he's going to get away with that?
I think
like,
he's decided he's walking away from this playoffs with $0 decided.
That's my take on it. Here's the thing. Now, people, there was some outrage. There was like a tweet. I think it was Barstool. It was like, there's kids in the arena. I'll tell you right now, if as a child, I was at Madison Square Garden and Reggie Miller flipped me off in a playoff game that the Knicks won, that would be one of the greatest memories of my life for absolutely ever. Forever, that would be an absolutely thrilling thing to reflect upon. I mean, he's going to get fined, right? Which, of course, the NBA has to do that. At the same time, it's kind of like, it's a little bit of spice for the pot, right? It's the playoffs. We enjoy this, isn't it? It's a nice thing to enjoy, isn't it? What was your view of that situation?
I thought it was a riot because, again, like I said at the top, like Kyrie just allows Boston fans to get into his head in ways that he's never allowed Cleveland fans to do. Like Cleveland fans have just as much right, if not more, to be pissed off at Kyrie. Mm-hmm. He walked away from a true championship contender. He walked away from a team he won a title with. But he's never let the Cleveland fan base bother him in the way that he lets a Celtic fan base. I mean, you know, like even the times when he's not, and I'm watching him most of the game, partly because he's going off the entire time, but even the times when he's not flipping off the crowd, he's reacting to them. Like he's communicating with people sitting in the baseline. He's kind of shrugging his shoulders, moving his hands as he's hearing things people are saying to him. So he's not blocking them out one bit. Now, I'm curious to see what the fine is for this. I mean, there were people around the Celtics that were like pushing for a suspension.
I mean, that's crazy. That's true.
I agree.
You might as well. But like, you might as well try it, right? You might as well throw that out there.
Exactly.
But like,
exactly.
That's
but it's like, well, the way it was, I was sitting in the press room and I heard from a couple of people on Sunday night where they're like, oh, you know, he did this once here, then he did it there, then he's walking the tunnel and he's cursing out whoever as he's going that way. So it's like, when's enough? When do you have to do that? So I guess you could push for it. It's not going to get suspended, but he'll get the heftiest fine you could possibly get for that. And I don't think he cares. I think he's going to keep responding in that exact same way.
So a 1-point win at the buzzer, but some indicators for the Nets that I think you could spin as positive. KD had a bad game, and as we've seen all season, and particularly in the run-up to the playoffs, if the Nets are going to need both of their guys, KD and Kyrie, to really go off for them to have a chance to win. It took both of them going crazy to beat the Cavs, etc. And they didn't, you're expecting Patty Mills and Seth Curry to space the floor a little bit more and allow Kevin Durant some more space to operate. Not that he shoots over everybody, but still make his life a little easier. And, you know, one shot for Patty Mills. Seth Curry was 1-for-4 from three. So there's a place where you expect a little bit of improvement. What do you think about this series? 7-game series?
Feels that way. Right. I think the Celtics will live with, Durant playing better. They're going to have to. He's not going to go 9-for-24. Right. Again, even though they played great defense on him. I mean, Grant Williams was excellent early on being physical. And then when he got into foul trouble, Tatum took over. And I saw some numbers on, kind of how well Tatum played defensively. The guys he was guarding just weren't scoring. And when they were scoring, it was really low percentage. So I think the Celtics will live with the kind of one-on-one-ish coverage that they have on Durant. What they're wary about and have been all week is who's that third guy? Like, right. If Kyrie goes for 30 and Durant goes for 40, fine, we'll live with 70. We don't want Bruce Brown doing what he did in the play-in game where he had 18 points. And even, look, the first half, what did Goran Dragic have in the first half? Like 11 points?
Yep.
Like that was certainly nerve-wracking to the coaching staff there. It's like, we can't allow Goran to come off the bench and be that kind of player. So look, if Durant gets 30 points and needs 30 shots to get it, they're going to call it a win. If Kyrie, you know, needs as many shots as points, they'll take that. It's just, they're wondering if Seth's going to go off with those three-point shots, or if Dragic or Brown or anybody else, even Claxton, you know, getting points in the paint. So it's more those guys than it is Durant and Kyrie that worry the Celtics.
I think we can all agree Kessler Edwards is not going to do anything.
He's not. No, that is correct. As much as Sam Hauser will do that.
He is Chris Mannix, Sports Illustrated NBA Insider. Chris, thanks so much for joining Take Line. Say hi to Nia Long. Enjoy the rest of the series. It's going to be a fun one.
Please do.
That's going to be fun.
You got it, fellas.
What a fun series. A season of turmoil, of chaos for the Utah Jazz, but all of a sudden in the playoffs, it's calm sailing. Luka Doncic, he's in great spirits, but he's not on the court. And so the Jazz, with a sloppy performance that never necessitated them getting out of like second or third gear, just easily dispatched with the Luka Doncic-less Mavericks in game one. And that means it's time to welcome our friend, beat reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, Andy Larson, the great Andy Larson, the historic Andy Larson. Andy, how are you? How are things in Jazzland, where I can only assume that things are more tranquil than they have been all season?
Yeah, you know, we talked to Bojan Bogdanović today and asked him, you know, like how the trust is within his teammates. And he started talking about the egos of everyone in the group. So that's, you know, a really good sign that everyone after game one is feeling really great and everything is awesome.
Oh, you gotta love it.
I love that. What did he say about the egos? I can't. This is.
Let me pull up the exact quote. So. He was asked if the game four win proved that they have developed more trust in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. And he says, it's about both trust and ego. We've got to put our ego to the side and trust each other, especially in these moments in the playoffs. We're here because we're a good team. We have quality. We really have a great group of guys who aren't looking for individual stats, especially like Rudy Gobert, having just one shot yesterday and being the best player on the floor. It's amazing. I don't know any other player who can do that.
Well,
it's inspirational stuff.
It's beautiful. I have chills right now.
Bojan has to be my favorite Croatian of all time. Just for the record.
My favorite Bojan thing is that the Jazz accidentally upload a YouTube video calling him the creation Bojan Bogdanović. Now so a group of fans have just been calling him the creation. And it's like the best nickname going for him besides, I guess, Bogey. But that's boring. You know?
The cut creator himself.
The Croatian creation.
And honorable mention of Kukoc, but it's Bojan's time now.
Yes.
Here's a question for you, sir.
Yeah.
Why can't N'Keal Walker-Alexander get on the floor for this team? If everyone hates each other, why not just put the guy who doesn't know anyone?
Everyone is strong.
He does work super hard, but like the big thing was like in New Orleans, he had the worst true shooting percentage in the league. That's actually a true stat. So, and I do think that, you know, Quinn cares about efficiency and not having N'Keal, miss some shots. So like, I like N'Keal a lot, especially in the draft. But like, yeah, he can't take that many bad shots and kind of be in a good team rotation, I guess, you know. Hopefully, you know, he should, you know, theoretically play over guys like Juancho Hernangómez and Daniel House and, you know, but
well, now,
even
hold on.
Trent Forrest.
I got it. Daniel House deserves a lot of minutes for that little stunt he pulled in the bubble for all the slutty boys, all the slutty boys back in the city. We appreciated that.
I agree. I love Daniel House. He has added a lot of character to this team. I'll tell you that much.
And he's not afraid to shoot the ball either. Andy. Do you feel it's been, as we said up top, a lot of questions about the Jazz, a lot of criticism from many corners. It's almost gone too far, like to the point where we just kind of discount the Jazz are a solid team. Like, how much do you think that kind of the criticism about can Mitchell and Gobert, like, how long can the friction between them go? Is this team fatally flawed? How much of that criticism is warranted, and has it gone to the level of we just have forgotten that this is a very, very, very good team with a player in Gobert who alone is able to elevate a team into, you know, the elite levels of NBA defense?
Yeah, you know, I think to some degree, probably. You know, I think essentially, like, the Jazz, definitely, you're right, like, have a good team and a lot of good players. Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert, Bojan Bogdanovic, Mike Conley, you know, yeah. I think you even look at the depth, it's pretty reasonable. And then I think the biggest issue is, A, you know, they're kind of pretty clearly, like, a step below the league's elite, yeah, both last year and this year. You know, like, you know, as much as they were good in the regular season last year, they were not that kind of caliber of playoff team. And then, you know, I think you kind of look forward and realize that, you know, they've got a really aging supporting cast, right? Yeah. Like Mike Conley, Bogdanovic, Rudy Gay, all these guys, you know, they traded away Joe Ingles. All these guys were in their 30s, mid-30s. And so it's like, how do you build a real contender around Donovan and Rudy, you know, kind of fringe all-NBA stars and definite all-stars, but yeah, kind of fringe all-NBA guys. You know, realistically, you probably need really talented role players around those guys. And the Jazz have just kind of run out of assets, yeah, to get those guys in order to put guys around them. You know, they won't have free agency cap space for the foreseeable future. Utah's not going to be a free agency destination anyway. And then, like, they've traded all their draft picks until, you know, they can't trade their next one until 2026. So it's like, it's just kind of the math becomes difficult too. And, you know, I think they could be a really good team. And hey, you know, there's kind of a Portland route for them to making a Western Conference Finals and really kind of contending. But it's just tough because, you know, we haven't seen maybe Donovan and Rudy kind of take that leap, right, that like a Ja Morant did, right? So anyway, I think there's kind of a lot of stuff going on that maybe even overrides the personality conflicts and the drama that we hear so much about.
So you think they're going to stay together? Like, someone's got to go. And I think Donovan's the face of the team. You think they're going to stay together?
I think so. They're like the three big faces of the team is Donovan, Rudy, and Quinn, right? Yeah. Quinn Snyder. And I don't think all three of them go. And I think the big question is it one, two, or three change this offseason? You know, right. You know, there's so much conversation about Quinn Snyder's contract and whether or not he wants to remain in Utah or whether or not he wants to go elsewhere. When I talked to him about it on the record a couple of weeks ago, he didn't really deny those rumors. He said it was inappropriate to talk about other coaching positions, but he didn't actually deny that, right? So I thought that was a little bit interesting. You know, and then I do think that there's, you know, the Donovan and Rudy are certainly not best friends. As Quinn said in that 19-minute rant, they occasionally sit at the same table sometimes.
I love that. I love that so much. They sit together at lunch sometimes. Okay.
When there's no other seat.
Yeah, so it's great. so, you know, I think I truly don't know if it's one, two, or three of those guys. Like, what's tough is that if you trade Donovan or Rudy, you're probably getting worse, right?
Right.
Like, I think, like, theoretically, like a Donovan for Damian Lillard kind of thing could be fun if you want to go crazy with it, but that's probably doesn't make sense. You're trading Donovan to the Knicks for a package of picks and young players or whatever it is, right? Or you're trading Rudy Gobert to the Hawks or the Mavs or whatever for a package of, you know, good role players and youth. But it doesn't make you better. And so it's hard to figure out, like, how do you kind of recalibrate or return the Jazz to being a real championship contender in the next, like, 5 years if you trade either one of those guys. It does just kind of make sense to rebuild a little bit. But that being said, the Jazz have the All-Star game next year. Owner Ryan Smith cares so much about making Utah look like a cool place,
yeah,
and kind of hosting a good party there, quite frankly. That I think he'll want to have a good team next year to some degree. So there's, like, just a lot of factors going on in this decision of how many of, you know, again, one, two, or three of those guys that you move on from.
With new ownership, you always look at the coach and think, you know, the people who are running the team always want their people there. On the other hand, Quinn Snyder is an elite coach. Like, Quinn Snyder is very, very good. There have been rumors linking him to the Lakers, as there have been for Nick Nurse. One, I don't know if relieved is the right word, but there must have been like a level of schadenfreude, right, when the Lakers just like bungled the Frank Vogel firing in such public like fashion. And could you take us through some of the frictions with Quinn? Because I think maybe from the outside in, for people who aren't like paying attention to the Jazz on a daily, right, they might think, well, hold on, Quinn Snyder's a great coach. Why would he go?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't think that would be Quinn Snyder. I don't think it would be the Jazz firing Quinn Snyder. Right. I think it would be Quinn Snyder moving on the other direction. And, you know, by the Mark Stein report says that they've tried to offer him an extension to continue, and he hasn't agreed to it yet, right? So I think that's kind of where that's coming from. And what Quinn cares about, I think, is I think you kind of look at his assistant coaching history, for one, and he's like, he went to five different assistant coaching jobs in 6 years, just because he was kind of trying to move around and learn as much as he could from some of the brilliant minds of the game. Like, what Quinn loves is like the X's and O's, intellectual, like chess move curiosity of basketball more than anything else. This team isn't like really about that. Like, he's solved the puzzle a little bit. He made the number one offense in the league, and it hasn't been enough, right? Like, what is the biggest problem now? It's like his stars don't get along, and it's a lot of kind of infighting and that kind of stuff. And then I think he's also kind of lost some organizational control here when Ryan Smith hired Danny Ainge to be the CEO and even the alternate governor in the board of governors meetings. So, you know, all of a sudden he feels a little bit uneasy of like what the franchise is going to look like moving forward, who's calling the shots. And, you know, I think he's kind of open to other possibilities out there, as like, hey, you know, what makes more sense for me and my career moving forward.
When you talked to Quinn, was he wearing that Jodeci vest? What's up with the vest?
He's wearing those vests all the time. And he only started doing it this year, so I truly have no idea.
Is it weights in there? Is it inflatable?
Yeah, I was like,
I think it's like one of those puffy jackets, but only vest form. Yes. But I don't know why he wears it so much.
I tweeted, and I believe Quinn has like, and I believe this. No, he looks like he just came out of a bank vault, you know, with and he's carrying like duffel bags full of diamonds
and Deutschmarks.
Deutschmarks, and he's about to escape like through an air vent and then hijack a subway train and escape.
He looks like Leon S. Kennedy in Resident Evil 4.
What were you gonna say, Andy?
Quinn's got some of the craziest style in the league. Like, I guess I'll say I don't hate it. Like, he's wearing Vans every game on the sidelines. He's worn some like Jazz kind of orange, the red, orange, yellow Vans kind of colors.
All right.
He's got like a inordinate number of wristbands or like bracelets on at any given time. Like, one time we asked him, like, Quinn, why are you wearing 8 wristbands? And he like clammed up, like all of them mean something to him in some way, but we don't know what. Like, he's a very, very private person.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is like one of the reasons why I don't think like the Lakers makes a ton of sense for him, because he'd be coaching the leakiest organization and like obviously the highest profile coaching job there is. But anyway, Quinn is remarkable. Like, I actually like respect the hell out of him. I love the guy, but he's certainly a unique human being.
Back to the game for a second. No Luka Doncic, no Tim Hardaway Jr. It's, you know, you're the Mavericks' creativity is going to come down to Spencer Dinwiddie, and that's not going to be enough. What level of concern do the Jazz have about this series? Assuming that Luka doesn't play for most of it, certainly I would expect that the Mavs absolutely have to get game 2. Like, they have to have it for this to be any kind of series.
It, you would think, and yet, like, you know, I think if Luka does come back and if he is able to be healthy, then, you know, obviously so much of it changes, and he can really kind of attack the parts of the Jazz's defense that are really weak. But, you know, I think they're at this point not that concerned. You know, I think they feel like they can defend the Mavs as they did in game 1, in future games without Luka. You know, in the end, that Spencer Dinwiddie and Jalen Brunson are not that much of a threat. And then you kind of look at the Mavs bench, quite frankly, and it's just non-existent, right? So you've got Maxi Kleba, who was a good shooter at the beginning of the year, has shot 18% from three since the All-Star break. You've got Josh Green, second-year player, also can't shoot. And then you've got Davis Bertans, right, who is...
Lafayette Laser.
Who is a bum. Let me take this for you. A bum! A rec league All-Star.
And that was their eight-man rotation in game one. Now, I don't know if you played Trey Burke or, like, Boban or what, Sterling Brown, but, like, they just don't have a lot of answers. And so, anyway, it's I think you just look at the depth and the talent the Jazz have without Luka on the floor, and they, you know, the Mavs don't have a lot of
You know what my favorite little bit from the run-up to the playoffs was when, you know, Luka had the calf strain and it was unclear what was going to happen, and every Mavs comment was, oh, well, he's in great spirits. Okay, but how is the calf? But he's in wonderful spirits, though. Don't worry about that. And he'll play. We think he'll play in incredible. His spirits are so high, and Mavs fans were like on this like conspiracy theory level where they're like, well, no. Listen, why would they let the Jazz know that Luka is healthy? As if the Jazz were just, oh, well, Luka's not going to play, guys. We're not going to game plan for him. Let's save time here, and let's just not prepare for Luka at all. As if they would just be like, oh, well, if Luka showed up, they'd just be like, oh, my God, what? What are we going to do? That's been one of my favorite. That's not really a thing that you need to answer, but that was just one of my little favorite things that was happening around the league in the last couple of weeks.
Well, and as like a beat writer, you're trying to figure out like, yeah, is this guy going to play? And so you read quotes from like Spencer Dinwiddie being like, I'm very optimistic Luka's going to play in game one. It's like, why did you say that? He didn't even practice. You weren't in the same room. You know, anyway, but clearly he's not close, right?
Not even close.
You watch the videos that he's not running. So
Tim McMahon showed a video of him from the training facility where like, and he's on a exercise bike going about as slow as you can possibly go on an exercise bike. Right. Like, it's like not going to happen, folks.
I don't know. As long as the Jordans keep coming out, I'm fine.
Jamal, I guess it's not necessarily safe to. Well, actually, let me ask this because I've been dying to ask. So Rudy dominated this game like without scoring. And I think much like the criticism of the Jazz, do you feel like I've never seen as disrespected a legitimately elite player ever as Rudy Gobert. I think like Rudy is clearly a great player, an unbelievable defender. He's like a defense in a box. Like you just unpack him and you have rim protection. You have everything you need for like a top 10 defense in the league. And yet nobody seems to fuck with him like at all. His co-star doesn't like him. Players around the league are often making not necessarily snide, but indirectly critical comments of Gobert. What is the deal with him?
It's the last pick in every All-Star draft. Yeah. Like I don't really know. The funny thing is like everyone who works at the Jazz loves him. Like he's the guy that like when the pandemic happened, he paid arena workers to, you know, that make sure that they could feed their families for the next month, you know, like, and then like, again, yeah, you talk to their teammates and he's like, Rudy Gay, for example, was like, you know, Rudy Gobert must be important. He's making $40 million a year. It's like, oh, geez, guys, like, why are you throwing these shots? Anyway, I truly don't know. I think some of it is like the European thing. I think some of it is like he doesn't play the game of, he is very like honest in press conferences, which means that honestly, he ends up taking shots at his teammates a fair bit after games. I think some of it is that like he is a super duper awkward player, right? Like terrific defensively. Elite. I think he's an elite athlete, but like just very awkward, right? Yeah. About how he goes about his business. And then, like, there's the fact that NBA players worship at the Church of Points. Yeah. Like, that is what is cool to NBA players is points. And Rudy's not a skilled offensive player, you know? Like, kind of all the work that they put in and jump shots and, you know, layup finishing and everything else, that's not Rudy's game. You know, Rudy's figured out this very unique way of impacting the game and things that they never practice, right? Lobs, screens, you know, killing it at pick and roll defense. Yeah. And, you know, that's it's not that sexy, I think, in the end. And I think kind of the respect level goes down as a result.
I blame George Bush. Yeah, man. Once they started calling them freedom fries, look, this goes back. This goes way back.
Did Tony Parker get this kind of hate?
A little bit. That's, Steven Jackson hates Tony Parker. He did get it
a little bit. He did get it a little bit. What can I ask? What happened when Rudy Gay? That was, man, the way that signing was talked about, like, oh, this is we're going to unlock it right here. This is his skill set, what he can do. This is exactly what the Jazz need. And then it just never arrived, never appeared in any kind of form. What happened?
I think expectations were too high, right? Like, if you talk to San Antonio people, Rudy Gay was not like an amazing player last year. And then, you know, yeah, he got old and had foot surgery in the offseason. So I think there is some injury comeback there. I think he is moving less well than last year. I think given that he doesn't fit a lot of what the Jazz want from that spot, which is kind of keeping the ball moving, you know, allowing kind of the rest of the offense to work. Rudy Gay is kind of a ball in hand guy. And so, like, he's been felt kind of awkward all year long of like, hey, I can't get to my kind of spots on the floor in terms of, you know, he's used to the mid-range jumper. He can knock down threes, sure, but it's not like his preferred game. And then he's kind of a defensive liability with the way that he's moving at age 35. And it's just like, you know, Juancho Hernan Gomez might legitimately be a better fit. And that's why we saw him in game one. So I agreed. Like, I think it's at the point where he's now an overpay and the Jazz might have to like use a pick to get rid of the contract. He's getting DNP CDs in the playoffs and it has been just like a big, yeah, overcommitment and a little bit of a underperformance, I think, for sure.
Finally, Andy, I'm going to ask you two things. One, your predictions for who is in the finals. And then two, let's say me and Jamel are in, we drive into Salt Lake. It's a beautiful day and, you know, beautiful Saturday morning. We want to get some brunch. What are the spots? Where do we find Andy Larson tucking into a delicious brunch on a wonderful Salt Lake City weekend morning? Let's start with the first question. Who's in the finals?
I'm calling a Suns-Bucks rematch.
Yeah, I think so too.
I know that the game ended up being close between the Bulls and the Bucks, but there are times where I watch Giannis and I'm like, how does this guy not win every NBA finals for the next 8 years, right? Like, even just in the first quarter, like, has that incredible Euro step and then hits a three on the next possession or throws it to himself off the backboard for dunks, just like stuff we don't see. And then the Suns are obviously
and awesome. That was also like classic game one Bucks worst game of the playoffs. Like, that's what that's going to be.
Miss every three. So I'm betting on those two teams. As for brunch, my spot in Salt Lake City is called Hopkins. It's Hopkins Brewing. I have a sweatshirt of theirs. I'm trying to see. Oh,
okay. I wasn't even sure you could drink beers out there. That's what's up. All right.
Listen, we have, and I'll have you know this,
got beers?
The sixth ranked craft brewery scene in America.
Okay.
Sixth.
All right. Baltimore.
Sure, there are five better than us.
Eat your heart out.
We're sixth.
Yeah, let's go.
Now, last time I was in Salt Lake, it was, and it's been a minute, but the last time I was there and we went out to drinks, there was like this interesting system where you would pay to get into the place, or sometimes you wouldn't, but they'd give you a ticket, and the ticket was like membership to...
When was the last time you were in Salt Lake?
It was like 10 years ago. It was like membership to the... the bar and so you were a member of this like club for the night, and that got you around some sort of zoning that allowed you to drink.
That was absolutely a thing. Now I'm looking it up. Like, I think that ended in like seriously 2009. That ended. So you haven't been in Utah at least 13
I'm
years.
I'm coming back, baby.
And yeah, now we have normal bars. Like the weirdest bar rule at this point is like you can't get doubles. And the on draft beer for whatever reason has to be 5% or below. You can get anything in a can and it can be whatever, but if it's on draft, it has to be 5%.
Oh, because drafts are too delicious. That makes sense.
That's yep. That, I mean, that's where they get the kids, right?
Yeah.
You see the draft and you're like,
kids don't know shit about draft beers.
They don't know about it. He is Andy Larson. You can find him at the Salt Lake Tribune and at Hopkins Brewery on weekends, tucking into that brunch for the top 10 rated craft beer scene in America, Salt Lake City, Utah.
Sixth.
Hey, that's top 10.
That's it for me and Jamel. That's it for us. That's it for Take Line. Follow and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe to Take Line Show on YouTube for exclusive video clips from this episode, plus my digital series, All Caps NBA, which airs every Friday during the NBA season. Check it out, folks. Goodbye. Ooh-oh. Take Line is a Crooked Media production. The show is produced by Ryan Wallerson and Zuri Irvin. Our executive producers are myself and Sandy Gerard. Engineering, editing, and sound design by the great Sarah DeWalaska and the folks at Chapter 4. And our theme music is produced by Brian Vasquez. Mia Kelman is on the Zoom for Vibes, and the Vibes are fantastic all the time.